Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
Hi, welcome to today's episode of Firefighting Fridays. I'm Jeff Diedrich with Strategic Fire Training. And today we have Jeff Shoup, Jerry Knapp, and John Mateer rounding out the group. Today's topic, talking about the fire service and its relationship with UL and also other entities that have helped the fire service with managing information and new technology. So let's get started from the beginning for us. That'd be our senior man, Jeff Shoup, and what he was seeing back in the 1970s as far as what was making the fire service do as far as change in technology, change in turnout gear, change in tactics, and how everything kind of relates to the work experience. So, Jeff, can you get us started off?
Yeah. Excuse me. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah, we got you.
Okay, good. All right. Well, You probably all heard the cry out there, the fire service is 150 years of tradition untouched by progress. And it's a lot of, there's a lot of truth to it in some areas, but not all, many are, not many areas. I'll get that right yet. And the reason I say that is because the fire service is one of those organizations that you feel is slow to respond to things. If you take a look at, like the early 1900s through the 1930s, the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and so forth, what firefighters were wearing for protective gear, the kind of fire trucks they drove, hell, there were departments still driving around in open cabs in the 60s and the 70s. Tillerman, have sitting in a bucket, and no protection around them at all for many years and so forth. Protective gear for firefighters, you had your choice of rubber coats, canvas coats, Hypalon, or no coat, meaning that, especially truck personnel, truck men would grab an old hunting jacket or an army field jacket, put their helmet on, their gloves, and grab their tool and go to work. And that was one of the interesting things, like when I first went on the job, and hearing why the different materials, cotton canvas versus rubber. Engine guys in some departments wore the rubber coats because rubber shed the water. Truck guys, squad guys, they would wear the canvas coat because they were dealing with water. I mean, it's a weird thing to hear him talk like that. And a question always came up, well, if he's on a squad right now, is there a chance he might work on an engine? Well, then what does he do? Get another turnout, go up, get a rubber or something like that. But here, when you take a look at what it was, the protection for the firefighter, and I've written this recently, and folks are going to see this in an article on 2-inch line coming up. I'm going to talk a lot about the history of the job. Not way back then, but in the 60s, 70s to where we are today. And you take a look at what firefighters worked with. The tools, their protective gear, the apparatus, especially in the 70s. Amazing. And I make the statement in there that considering what we in the fire service had to work with back then, and especially with the number of fires that you were attending to and so forth, you did the impossible for the communities that you were working for. Really, that to me is a very true statement. It was this. And by the way, see, here's one of the things I do. I collect things over the years. This is my old Union Firefighter magazine from 1976. And this is the May of 1976 issue. And here, you heard me talk many times about Project Fires. Well, here in this May of 1976 magazine, Union Firefighter magazine, it talks about the start of Project Fires. and Project Fires, F-I-R-E-S, was that acronym, Firefighters Integrated Response and Equipment System. And see, this is where we started seeing changing in the fire service. So let's just say in the 60s, you know, New York City was already moving inch and three quarter and rapid water, things like that. In the 70s, now it's catching on. But in the 70s, with the Project Fires thing going, you had many fire departments taking part in this. Let's take a look at this equipment. Let's take a look at this way of doing things and so forth. The movement to two-inch hose, automatic nozzles, turnout gear. I had turnout gear or turnout coat issued to me in 74. And the only thing fire resistive or protective about it, you might say, was the outer shell, because it was Nomex. And Nomex back then had two different weights, 6 ounce per square yard and 7.5 ounce per square yard weight. The rest of the coat, it could burst in a flame or whatever, you know, but that's all we knew back then. So something like that, Project Fires got the ball rolling. So let me show you something else here. Here's the thing, you know, again, when you heard me talk, I talk about firefighters, the turnout gear, the protection you got today, you can thank the guys who were on the job back then and what was done to get you the protection that you're afforded today. That's why when I hear this stuff about the UL studies and the NIST and all this other stuff, let me show you this one. This is one on protective clothing, okay? And what they had done in the development of our turnout gear was took a look and did things, you know, like break down the ranges of environments faced by firefighters at that time. And then took a look at the human tolerance level. When you take a look at the human tolerance level, those temperatures faced and so forth, and what the firefighters were expected to face. That's why when I hear all these guys talking about, you know, diving into a building fully involved, you know, to save somebody or something like that, you know, don't worry about the hose. Like, no. This is stuff that we had worked on years and years and years ago. So I think, you know, a lot of people need to get into books and go back and read this stuff. The body's response to cold. Look what we're dealing with here in eastern United States with the cold spell. So how do you develop a turnout gear to protect you from super heat conditions and super cold conditions, to protect you, the firefighters, so you can do your job, things like that.
Yeah, I would interrupt you there, and I would say that some of the newer gear, at least for me, that I'm wearing, is not as good in cold weather as some of the older blends that I've used over the years since 94.
That very well could be.
I think they ventilate, they off-gas a lot faster, and I think that translates to gear that's not as efficient as keeping you warm when it's super cold out, you know?
Yeah. Just to shed some light on another thing that we did back then, I was the subcommittee chair in Cleveland back in the 80s when we were one of the departments that was a Project Fires, like many others. You had Fort Worth, Chicago, New York, LA. Many of the big fire departments from coast to coast were participating in the field testing. So one of the things that you're hearing about this stuff today, this is what's kind of neat, you know? It's like, you don't want to say, hey, we've already been there, done that, and so forth, but it's true, you know? Like I said, this is all, by the way, when I hear the word science in the fire service, this was science. Because when you take a look at the way they develop materials and how they created the energy to check how well this material was going to hold up to protect us, the firefighters, under how long of a period before the material would start to degrade. And that was the development of the three protective layers. Okay. As I said earlier, fire coat, you had the protective outer shell, the rest of it was combustible. And then we decided, you know, go with the thermal barrier and the moisture liner to help protect the firefighter even more. So all that was looked into the value of the TPP, they called it, the Thermal Protective Performance Rating. So all this, you know, was coming together way back then. On top of that, and again, it goes back to Project Fires, I got off the track here, but as a chair, I was responsible, and this was happening not only us, but other departments. What kind of station wear are we going to wear? You had your choice of 100% cotton, which had an FR treatment. You had 100% Nomex station wear. You had FR9B. You had polyvinyl rayon, PVR. You had 100% wool. There was like, I think, 9 different materials that we had station wear that was manufactured from, and we were wearing it, you know, so we had forms to fill out. You know, I had guys that were wearing these different materials, and they would have to fill out their duty for what they did that day, you know, for they wore that. You know, like we found out about the 100% cotton that was fire retardant treated. After a few washings and wearing it under, you know, good firefighting conditions, you found out the fire retardancy was wearing out real quick. And with the washings or the material getting wet and things like that, it was puckering. You know, you and I talked about that, Jeff. You know, it looked like the guys were wearing Levi's. That wasn't Levi's they were wearing. That was FR, or like I said, FR cotton. And a lot of times guys looked like they were wearing those Navy flood pants, you know, because the material was shrinking. And the guys, but it had a tag on it that said FR, meaning fire retardant. And so dad put them on in the morning, wear them to the firehouse, not think about it, you know, and pretty soon, you know, they were getting beat up pretty well. And it was just one of those things, you know, that changed its appearance, changed the way it was protecting, and it really wasn't. You and I were talking about the Nomex station wear.
Yeah.
Now, we were being pushed, you know, back then to wear 100% Nomex. And believe me, the first strains of station wear made of Nomex, it was like wearing sandpaper. You know, your body was just being, you know, rubbed, you know. And it was uncomfortable. And the other thing was, it was expensive. You know, you take the late 80s, you know, what you were making and what your clothing allowance might have been. And you figure 50 bucks for a pair of pants back then that you were supposedly going to be mandated to wear, along with a $35 fatigue shirt and all the other stuff. You know, I was like, holy cow, you know, this is getting pretty expensive and so forth. So what was the benefit and so forth? And there are all people who said, hey, well, we got to, you know, just fall back and stay with what we had, which was 65-35, 65% cotton, 35% polyester. And guys said, well, that's permanent press. And at 350 degrees, permanent press bursts into flames. And I heard one old guy said, at 350 degrees, I burst into flames. So what was the gain and so forth? We had a fire in about 86. A guy from my company got trapped on a fourth floor and very severely burned. And the whole thing was our turnout gear. It wasn't wearing boots. You know, we had just moved to fully encapsulated turnout gear. And the interesting thing, when we got his station pants back to quarter, he was crawling through fire. He got caught in the hallway of this big hotel. And I mean, it just took off like a Roman camel on the 34th floor. And back at quarters, we had his, you know, station wear and so forth. And you pulled his pants inside out to take a look at things. You saw his knees were burned into the, you know, knee area of his pants because he had crawled through. Well, again, that was heat energy transmission because he would crawl on the floor, you know, and it was just, you know, one of those things that, number one, drove home the point about fully protective envelopes. Number two, critical areas of compression, shoulders, knees, you know, things like that, where you needed extra protection, extra padding and things like that. So anyways, that stuff along with fire equipment, you know, the movement to 1¾, the movement to 2-inch, which we'll see come out next month, the next month's Fire Engineering Magazine on 2-inch hose. all kinds of educational stuff, how to attack fires and things like that. It was all out there back then, all discussed and, you know, gone over on Project Fires.
Yeah, and that, I think for us, that those that have come out of the job, you know, after that, it's important to recognize that as new technology has come available, it's rapidly integrated into the fire service. I mean, there's, if you think about it, what type of fireman wouldn't take the chance on or try some new thing to just to see it out for themselves? I mean, when we have availability to a new tool, whether it's better gear, better breathing apparatus, better fire hose, whatever it is, I mean, we're willing to look at it, you know, and like prove me wrong that it doesn't work or that it does work, you know. And I think that the fire service is always changing, and it's a matter of managing the change so it doesn't go down the path where it changes the mission or violates the principles. If we could stay with what we are here for, which is not just saving property but saving lives, you know, if we're here to save lives and then control the fire, I think that's the principle we need to stay with. You know, we need to be willing and then able to do those things. Jerry, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, Jeff, I think it's the key to all this research. You just can't take the research, you know, you have to meld that with experience and you know, what's our mission? What are we doing? How are we doing it now? Does this new stuff or what's purported to be new stuff, does that help? Does it hurt? Does it work? Doesn't it work? You know, you just can't, you know, they always say throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, in this case, we can't throw the baby in with the bathwater. You know, it's, you just gotta, there's no free lunch. You know, there's no silver bullet, you know?
And I think that when you melt all this into the different generations in the fire service, and how each generation kind of perceives their own experience in the fire service, that's when things get dicey. I mean, when we have the transition of the boomers to my generation, you know, me and John, you know, we look at things a bit differently, mostly the same, but a bit differently. And now we're handing off to the millennials and they're looking at things differently. And we seem to question the, I guess, the information sometimes from a position that maybe doesn't seem like it has validity to that older generation. But for my generation, it seemed like we were always looking for the black and white, you know, what's the right answer? What's the wrong answer? Just give me the data so I can, you know, further my argument. And that, I think it was the perfect trap for when we got into some of the other studies that came along, some of the things that were actually really, really great and helpful, and they kind of cemented in the argument, and then others that made us all sit up and pay attention, like, wow, that actually makes sense. We were talking as a group earlier about the door control study showing, you know, different temperature ratings and how the ventilation openings that we make as an engine crew to make entry can make a big difference. And if you could, you got the share screen tab there, Jerry. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that if we could.
Okay. Having some trouble with this. This is probably the best one. I don't know if you guys can see this clearly or not.
We can see it. Looks like you need to hit the full screen on it, maybe. There you go.
Yeah. So this was some of the stuff that Underwriters Laboratories did. And I was fortunate enough to be picked to be one of their tech panel members for their interior fire attack study. And so I think the value of all this is that, Jeff, like you just said, we can put numbers to it. You know, like we've all been to fires. We go, man, it was hot. Well, for the test fires that UL does, they can tell you second by second how hot or cool it was and that kind of thing. So, again, I think the key is using that data and blending that with our experience to take us to the next step. And not necessarily, that doesn't necessarily mean that where we're at is wrong. You know, you analyze that data, you bounce it against your experience, and you decide, hey, maybe we don't want to do that. Or, yeah, maybe that is better. Or, hey, look, that proves what we've been doing all along is right. So when Strategic Fire goes out, one of the things we teach is door control. And Jeff Shoup does a great demo with keeping the door closed, cracking it a little bit open, getting water in on the fire, then opening the door all the way and getting massive amounts of water on the fire with something like a portable monitor. So if we take, and Jeff, from his vast experience, knows that that works really well. Well, what does opening and closing the door do to the temperatures? And this slide, again, this is from Steve Kerber's UL study on residential fires. And I believe this came from New York City. I can't think of the name of the place right now. They did a bunch of tests, Governor's Island testing. So very realistic testing. But again, the value of this is, if you look in the upper left of the slide, when the door is open, it's about 500 degrees, the fire is free burning. You close the door, fire gets choked down and drops to 250. You can all can look at the numbers, rest of the numbers for yourself. But now we know, what's going on. The trap is, and this was one of the contributions that I made to the study that we did was, and it was $1.5 million study on fire attack in its residential buildings. And again, we all, as firemen, we all want to look for the silver bullet, right? Well, this is what happened at this fire in these conditions, at this particular kind of building with this particular kind of fire. So we got to be careful. The research is terrific and the data is wonderful, but you can't extrapolate this to a warehouse fire. This is the testing was done for residential fires. Super duper stuff, but that there are limitations to the study,
Jerry, you're doing a great job of bringing that to light. Thank you. Now, a question I have for you on this, and that is this taking into account the different types of construction and materials? Because like we say in our group, firefighters have got to three things. It's circumstantial, local, and geographical. Because things change, from one part of the country to the other. So can you run with that?
So yeah, I can. I think, Jeff, what's important is that, again, this data in this building. So can we apply this to a little different kind of house? Yeah, maybe, right? This is under this one particular ventilation condition. If you look to the left side of the slide, mm-hmm. I believe the front door is the only ventilation opening. So if that's the condition you roll up to, I think it's safe to assume you can expect the fire to react the way this test fire did. If the back window, kind of in the middle to the right here, I don't know if you can see my cursor now, like if this window is open, it's a different game. Yeah. It's a different game.
Yeah.
So as firemen, firefighters in the real world, we need to understand that, as conditions vary, like you said, these numbers are going to vary. And so again, it's a blend of the data and right. I think you got to temper that with experience to say, is this generally what we expect, And Jeff, to your point about circumstantial, if this is a wind-driven fire, we all know it's a different game. So, yeah. So if this back window is open, right, and the wind, you got a 20-mile-an-hour wind blowing, and there was a fire. I think Mark Bashur did a great video. They almost killed a couple of guys at a wind-driven fire in a very small house. So, but I think the value of this is at least it gives us hard numbers to look at. And also gives us trends to say, oh, okay, I understand that fire development a little better. We shouldn't take this blindly. We should question it. Look at it. Does it apply to us? Does it? Like Jeff, you said, do you have houses like this in your first new area? This was a row house on Governor's Island. So. Maybe it's very applicable to your area. Maybe it's not. You know, if you all you have is McMansions, sorry.
And again, like I said, I appreciate you running with this like this because, you know, I'd like to think I'm not the only guy who said, yeah, the science, you know, or the experimentation, let's call it, is a great thing, but you can apply it in all facets, okay? And to me, it's a generality. Because I fall back on the two older gentlemen no longer on this earth with us, you know, Freed and Clark. And there's a lot of people before them where they got their stuff from who came up with stuff and saw these conditions and remarked about them and so forth. So to me, it's a generality that, you know, firefighting is more of a way of doing business. It's a, you know, principles that we follow and things like that. And the thing about our group that I believe that we're always going to hold steadfast on is that you got the members here that say, okay, so much water, so much heat, so much movement, the air temperature, like you pointed out, you know, at this second of the game, and then 20 seconds later, it's going to be this temperature and so forth. That all get to me is telling us, and I think we do a great job of telling people, you take as much firepower into a fire as you can, because you don't know what can happen. If that window breaks and feeds that fire, it becomes wind driven. Or if somebody opens a door over the, you know, whatever the case may be. So, okay, now let's just go.
So I think this research has other value. It gives you, like you said, that general understanding. Yeah. So when guys get to do, or gals get to a fire ground, they can go, okay, that window's open, that door's open. Here's what I can probably expect. So you can kind of anticipate. And again, there's no silver bullet. You got to think about, you know, there's different situations, you know, like we've said, hey, Jeff, Mike is trying to get in. He needs approval to come in.
All right. Well, Micah's getting set up here. Sure. So with the impact of this study here, I mean, the Governor's Island study was, I think, the one that really got, at least in my area, got a lot of the fire service paying attention. For one, they were picking up a lot of experience-based information from that area of the country that has a long history and has a lot of experience. So when, and it just goes without saying, when one of the oldest and largest fire departments in the world is paying attention to something, everybody else kind of falls in line. So what we found out there from our perspective was a new respect for wind direction when it comes to your standard little house fire. And also there was another, I think it was around the same time the IFF did a manpower study, a staffing study, showing how much more effective the work gets done when vehicles are staffed with at least four. And I mean, it was an incredible study that got almost no fanfare. I would encourage everybody to go find it.
1710, is that the one you're talking about? 1710?
I think it was by the IFF. I don't think NFPA.
Okay.
I think NFPA was using it to build 1910. But
1710.
Or 1710. It was a huge, you know, like, oh, wow, look at that. I mean, they were able to qualify the amount of time it takes to get the standard amount of work done at a single family dwelling fire. And it's like, if your vehicles are only staffed with three, this is generally how long it's going to take. If it's two, this is how long it's going to take. If you're waiting for, you know, 6 to 10 minutes for a first arriving unit, this is what it'll end up happening. It was a great breakdown. So that, with the Governor's Island study, to me, was like, wow, here we go. We got several hundred pages of real information that we can use as firefighters to not only make the argument for staffing, but then to also pay attention to what kind of strategies we're using because of the staffing levels that we're at. So that was, I think, a great start for me when I was in those middle children years of the fire service, you know, 7, 8, 10 years. Where you think you know just enough to get hurt, and that's usually what happens, right? So it's good to keep paying attention and learning. Hey, welcome to the show, Micah. You're on, you want to unmute yourself and say hello?
I think he's frozen right now.
Yeah, he's frozen. It'll be really cold out there.
He's got that
there he is.
Cheap fire department internet over there.
It's all they can get. That's all they can get out there in Kansas.
Yeah. Well,
the land of Oz.
And the guys.
You might have to reboot.
Yeah. Me. Don't worry about me.
Well, before we lose any more traction. I just want to get into 2015, 2018, and what I thought were, for me, were pretty important years in the fire service. And, 2015, you know, the study was released about using, you know, fire streams from a safe area, most of which was tied to the teaching component of slicers and using exterior water whenever possible, as soon as possible. And even though in that study it said interior streams need to be studied, the impact of putting firefighters in the building needs to be studied. It was something that part of the study was completely lost on the majority of the fire service, and everybody jumped onto the teaching component, which was showing, you know, well, we can reduce temperatures by putting water in from the outside before we go in on every fire. And that became almost the mantra or marching orders. And then those of us in the other camp are like, wait a minute, putting water from a safe place could be from the bottom of the stairs. It could be from the approach hallway. It could be from inside the building. It doesn't have to be from the outside. If you can get in there and then make it work. But this whole thing has made its way into the fire academies across the country. And that's the interesting thing. Like, these federal grants to do these studies, they don't happen unless you have a teaching component attached to the back end of your study. And I think that's important for people to know that, you know, the federal grants to pay, like that $1.5 million study or that door control Jerry was talking about, that study doesn't get done unless somebody can outline how they're going to teach that and roll that out to the fire service. So, John, you've been spending a lot of time at the Cleveland Fire Academy lately.
Yeah, a little bit.
Back me up on this. Is this exterior stream still very much part of the Ohio, specifically Cleveland curriculum?
They talk about it, but it all depends on who the instructors are. I mean, how much they want to really delve into it or teach it and move on quickly. And, you know, I think part of the problem, though, is like you said, back in 15, mm-hmm. everyone jumped on it. We're going to hit it hard from the yard. We're going to do this. We're not going in. Everything turns into a transitional attack, or as they like to call it, offensive attack from outside. And you have a lot of people who usually based on experience levels. Who the ones who are more experienced, they were like, no, I don't think we're going to go that route. We're going to go this route. And the ones who maybe didn't have the experience were like, oh yeah, that's great. It's safer for everybody. It's this, it's that. And again, we go back to what Shoop talked about early on. What's our mission in the fire service? It's to save lives. That's our number one goal. And we talk about the proper placement of a hose line between the fire and the victim saves more lives than anything we do in the fire service. Yeah. But you talk about that survey, right? They sat outside for 30 seconds throwing water into this building. That's 30 seconds. Someone has to try and survive in an environment. And people don't take that stuff into consideration when they start teaching it and going, yeah, that's what we're going to do. That's why we're doing it. And it's like, well, not really sure we want to go that deep into it, you know?
When we started hearing the words resetting the fire. And another tool, here's another one, another tool in the toolbox. I mean, we hear these cliches over and over and over and over and over. And for those of us on this side of the argument is, you know, you could say that, or you can actually just practice getting your face piece and hood up fast, getting the line out, getting water to it with appropriate pressure, and making your way into the building and putting fire out. Like, let's stick with what we know really, really works here. Is there a benefit to knowing that the quicker the water goes in, the quicker the fire goes out? But yeah, isn't that something we've always been saying? You know, the quicker we put water on, the quicker the fire goes out.
Exactly. Since the 1800s.
A question for you guys. Do you think the people who wanted to implement this, I think there's many people out there who believe they had personal goals or personal ideas or personal something to get this instituted for whatever reason. And again, they're going to take over the fire service. Now, the other thing is, I remember a gentleman who's no longer with us running all this ICS stuff. And if you remember when ICS came into the fire service, okay, we had all these things that we had to learn. And I remember clearly, and you were just talking about transitional, offensive transitional. That's something that somebody who's got an agenda will do, is put all these little catchphrases or all these neat words and so forth. The guy's thinking about that. Oh, yeah. Anyway, this gentleman said, and he was a fire service icon, there's no such thing as in between. If it's either offensive or defensive, you can't have it both ways. So here we see.
I agree with that.
Oh, sure. And now we see a group of people coming in who have their own personal agendas for the fire service. And now they're saying words or phrases like, oh, no, it's an offensive transitional position. Bullshit. It's defensive.
And what if you're hitting it from outside? If you're hitting it from outside, it's defensive.
It's not offensive.
By definition, it's defensive.
Right. So this is one of those things where we're going to mislead, misrepresent, and outright lie to the people.
Shoop, I'll cut you off there for a second, but we are not saying that transitional attack should never happen. It always happens. It will always happen. There are fires you just can't go into until you knock some of that fire down.
Absolutely right.
But it shouldn't be your first thought in route to the fire. Oh, we'll start hitting it from outside.
Right.
Taking nothing else into consideration. You know, you're first arriving. That should not be your thought that we want to go transitional.
You see right here, we're going right back to situations and being circumstantial.
Right up. I don't feel you can make a decision until you get on scene what you're going to do.
Oh, right. Exactly. If you took a look at that one IFSTA put out there, it's like an 18-minute video on YouTube. You can look it up. Anybody can look it up. You know, it's like, oh, okay, what a selling job this is. So it's out there.
I think that among all the studies, the one that really kind of hits it home, I think, for anybody that's looking to learn more about the job, is the coordinated fire attack study, where they prove over and over and over that your best case scenario is a coordinated ventilation that is happening right in front of the attack crew. And this all sounds very familiar to those of us that have been doing this on an experienced level, but it's been documented, it's been temperature mapped, it's been proven that, you know, as water's going on the fire, we need an exhaust port for those steam and off gases, and everything gets better really quick. And it also, for me, when you look at the coordinated fire attack study and you also look at the interior stream study that came out in 2018, as an engine guy, I need to have it in my head. John, you're talking about the mindset. When you're faced with a residential building on fire and there's smoke showing, the most efficient thing you can do is get a hose line full of water and at the door and get in, period. That is by far your number one thing that's going to make things better. Whether you can hit the fire right from there, or if you can get a few feet in and make the turn and get the water going, you're more likely to find somebody in that hallway, approachway, it's trying to get out of that building there, than going around to the seaside to throw water in the window.
And you know, it's funny, Jeff, is, you know, the book they use for the state test talks about that. going in immediately. But then they talk about doing transitional, and then they talk about doing slicers. So they give you all these different conflicting approaches to doing it.
Right.
And I think that's where, that's where we went wrong, is that these things were thrown out there with no like priorities, right? So I remember talking to Bill Gustin. His father was a firefighter in Chicago in the 50s and 60s. And he said his father, they called it giving it a dash from outside before they went in. So again, transitional attack, they were doing it in Chicago in the 50s and the 60s, according to Gustin, and I'm sure they were. The other thing about transitional attack, I think we got to understand is this, is that like Jeff says, it's situational. So if the truck company is having a hard time forcing a door and you can't get in, do you, and again, I got this from Bill Gustin, we were at FDIC just yakking, and he goes, so you got fire blowing out this window next to the door. You got a charged hose line. The truck can't get the door open for whatever reason. Do you just sit there and let that fire burn, or do you put some water on from the outside? And again, I taught at my fire training center for years. Oh, don't ever put water in. You're going to push fire all over everybody, blah, 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 blah. Well, now we know you can push hot air and maybe push some fresh air into different areas that cause the place to light up. Are you going to push flames? No, you're not going to push flames with a hose line, right? And you can push what appears to be fire on and heat onto people. I got it. And that's the experience side, right? But now we know from the testing that in a residential setting with that limited fire load, you're probably not going to push flames onto somebody. Now, you go to a warehouse fire with, different, sofas stacked up 20 feet high, different story, But again, we this is where we go wrong as firemen all the time. There's no silver bullet for everything. For crying out loud, Jeff keeps saying situational, situational, situational. He's exactly right. You got to freaking use your head. You just can't, go, oh, yep, I'm going to put water on fire. Crying out loud. Sorry, I put myself.
Yeah, no, that's away. Good. Yeah, big part of the situation.
I got off mine. You're allowed on yours, Jerry.
All right, thanks. I appreciate borrowing that box, Josh.
No problem.
The situational part, it's already understood, but it needs to be said, is that situational part of it is the experience and the training mm-hmm. level of the crew, mm-hmm. the amount of crew, and what kind of equipment are they using? How are they ready to get in and go deep, mm-hmm. or are they not that fire department? So when this whole argument comes to be, and you've got a couple different fire services out in the country here. We got, people with zero to almost mm-hmm. no experience in a rural setting, getting there after it's through the roof most times. Mm-hmm. And then you've got urban areas where engines are getting on fires super quick. So it doesn't make sense. This one size fits all thing. It doesn't make any sense at all. I think that was the big tragedy of that whole thing.
Yeah, and I don't know that was on the researchers. I think it was on the transmitters. I think it was on the receivers, which is us.
It was the way we interpreted the information, and it was like, did you read the 331 pages? No.
Yeah. I will speak for my department. That was definitely preached to our department. So, to be hitting it from outside. So yeah. I'll just leave it at that. Mm-hmm.
And like I was saying earlier, like our generation, John, we were looking for that black and white. Give us the data. Show us what's right and wrong. Why do we need to think about this? Just prove it to us and we'll go that way with it. That was how my generation was looking at this thing. That was my interpretation of it. My blessing, my problem is I had a backstop of, whichever way Jeff is sitting in your box over here. I had this guy at the back of my head since the Academy days saying, this is not the principle. This doesn't fall in line with what you swore to do. You're not going to take your time getting in. If it was your house, would you take your time getting in?
That was your family in there. You want to let them burn for 30 seconds more and hope you get a save.
Right.
Okay. So you do what you gotta do. And we've all thrown this out there before, too. Today's American firefighter has the best protection at any time in the history of firefighting in this country. You've got the best there is. Mm-hmm. Turnout gear, SCBA, and again, like what we talk about with fire attack, take as much into battle with you as you can.
Mm-hmm.
You go in and you just kill that environment. So I think this leads to something else. And I was talking with a person recently, within the last few weeks. We were talking about training program. I don't know if I talked about this with you guys before. Here you got a training program, 16 to 22 weeks long, doesn't matter anymore. Everybody's got to go 16, 20, 22 weeks of training. They got a 1,700-page training manual. And this person was telling me, he says, you know what? You take a look at how many pages in that book are actually about firefighting. And it's horrible. It's all about everything else. And then, of course, the training, you know, they go out, they pull a couple lines, they go into a fabricated burn building, you know, whether it's steel or concrete or something like that. And again, they're following the standards because that's the one thing that's going to get jammed down these new kids' throats. And that is, you got to follow the standards. So the standards say we got that, what, that 1403 live burn, whatever, you know, we got to be careful for this. We're teaching firefighters with the best protection to be cautious because the job is so, so dangerous. And we're putting fear in our firefighters. So like when I come on the job, I was like, kid, this is what you signed up for. This is what we do. And that's the way it is. And son of a gun, we survived. And we learned the principles and the practices. We didn't have this stuff back then. We didn't have computers. And again, thankfully, the Project Fires got underway and got us better equipment, better turnout gear, better everything for the fire service now. And now we're taking a step backwards and, dare we say, aggressive because it might offend somebody in regards to firefighting. Oh, my God, come on. Anytime you can get that line inside of a structure, especially if there's a life concern, it should be in there. And again, John, Jerry, everybody, we all know there's fires that we have to hit to get inside.
Absolutely. Okay. We've done that the time.
We're not arguing that. Yeah. What we're arguing is what you guys just made perfectly clear. People were looking for a black and white way of doing business and a one size fits all. And that's wrong. So maybe this whole thing needs to be thrown out. Go back to the principles and practices and let's start over.
Because I can start.
We've learned a lot more from these people over this period.
I think we got to take a look at the bigger picture. You know, we're all like water on the fire, water on the fire, water on the fire, right? Most of the UL studies were about residential fires, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I first started, and some of you guys probably heard the same thing, we had a 20-minute rule. And I always say we were allowed to play around in a residential fire 20 minutes before we had to be worried about collapse, right? And, you know, there's some older houses around where I live in an old, you know, northeastern town. So we have a lot of these old balloon frame buildings that there might have been fire all over the place, but we had 20 minutes before we had to worry about falling through the floor. We know now from the UL studies about the new lightweight construction, it's not new anymore. It's 30 years old, right? But we still calling it new, that those wooden eye joists will withstand about 6 minutes of fire before you go through the floor. So again, we can argue about how much water we should take in or what we should do or whatever, but we got to look at the big picture. And the big picture is the battlefield has now changed. So I'm not saying don't go in, but we need to understand that we're going into a building that's not going to withstand a fire load like when we started. So I always tell the recruits and stuff, I go, look, the world changes a little bit each day. We need to change a little bit each day to keep pace with it. You know, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but the world's changing around us. And building construction, you know, I don't need to tell anybody that's listening to this podcast about building construction. It's different now than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago, right? And those shabby new buildings are around and those old buildings are around. I'd rather go to a fire in an old blue frame building with fire all around me than some of these new shacks they put up, you know?
I agree with you on that one, Jay.
You're better off if you're a truck man or a squad guy on the roof of one of those old buildings
They're not going to collapse.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they'll burn through, but they're not going to collapse.
Funny to see the fire rolling out through a big hole and the guys are up there, you know, stuff like that, you know, because it's solid, you know, with that ridge board intact. And it's not
real,
like that.
Real dimensional wood, all that.
Right. Now, on the other hand, it's not always like that with every fire.
Yeah.
So Jerry, see,
there's this. Here's one of those things about these guys teach a class. They give a shopping, a grocery store card to people. It's a certain color, you know. Pass it out. Stay off all roofs. They're horrible, you know, and stuff like that. You know, bullshit. It's not one size fits all. It's not a black and white world.
Big stuff picture.
Like exactly. Right. What do you have in your community, and what do you deal with?
Yeah.
Funny story, by the way, about an old, this is going back many years ago when I was a young fireman. We had a fire one night in this joint, you know, had been vacant for some time. And I was young, and I was following this lieutenant who was an excellent fire boss, took care of his guys and everything. And I get off the ladder, step off onto the porch roof, because we were going to enter the second floor. This joint was rolling pretty good, you know. My 1 foot goes right through the roof, and I go up to my thigh in the roof. And he went inside the one window, took a look down the hallway, came back, and just back it out. In the meantime, part of the building started to collapse. So, Jerry, you talk about those old wood frame, balloon frame constructions. This is how lucky some guy could get. That bump out, you know, as you were coming to the steps to go upstairs from the first floor, how they used to have that bump out maybe 2 feet, you know, you're walking, you know, and then you got the landing right there. That detached from the house, and there was a window there, and guys were screwing as this place is coming down. And here's a guy, he just started to walk, and that thing came down, and we thought, oh my God, it's gonna kill him. And the window frame fell right around him.
All situational.
Absolutely. it didn't look good from the start.
Mike, did you have something to say?
Oh, well, just to retract, Jerry, from what you were saying and describing about we have less time to get in and put the fire out from the older days, would you say that that's more of a reason why we need to get in quicker and with a larger GPM?
I think you got to know, Micah, that if, for example, if you have a fire underneath one of these I-joist supported floors, you're going to go through the door and through the floor, possibly. So, again, like Jeff says, it's situational. You need to know, and the other guys were just talking, you need to know what's in your first due area. Maybe you shouldn't go in that way, or maybe there's an alternate tactic. Again, it depends on the situation, but I think what's important is the ICs and the guys need to know all those possibilities and make the best decision based on their size up when they get there. You know, again, if, you know, there's a report, a reliable report of 4 kids trapped on the second floor, maybe you decide you're going to take the chance, you know, maybe you don't. But knowing the options, I think, is the key. And nobody can tell you what to do with a fire, you know, beforehand. You base it on what you see, you know. So I like the old RECO days, rescue, exposures, confine, extinguishment, overhaul. And people say, well, what about size up? Well, first of all, if you need to tell a guy the first thing you need to do with a fire is size it up, he's probably in the wrong business. So I always like RECO because rescue is first. Everything, the way I was taught that was, everything, if there's a rescue situation or search, just like you say, everything that goes on the fire ground supports that, period. Now, how you do it is the situational based on what you're seeing, but you know what your mission is, you know what your priority is.
Very good.
Yeah, very, very concise point. I mean, the true incident commander is who's in that forward area, you know, if it's a crew trying to go for that immediate rescue, everything's got to fall in support behind them. If the crew's making an interior attack, you know, everything that everybody's job that shows up after that is to make sure that they get to their objective, because if they don't make it to the seat of the fire, then we're going to be here a long time and it's going to be a lot worse than it should. Mm-hmm. So I think to Micah's point, for me as a boss, what I try to do is I eliminate my worst case scenarios and work back. So is it a basement fire? Nope. Okay. So there's no through the door, through the floor. What's my next priority that I'm thinking about? Mm-hmm. Getting that line into the building. Where do I want the line to go? Well, where's the fire going? And I kind of work back from there.
And I think this idea, and Mike, about being aggressive, doesn't mean you have to go through the front door. Maybe there's another aggressive way to do it, you know, but take it in the big picture of, well, just like Jeff said, you know.
So, can you guys hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So, you know what this reminds me of? This is something that we brought up before, and it's about don't try to take the idea of how firefighters or how firefighting should happen in a small rural operation and have a lot of political strength or pull and try to get your agenda put into a big city operation. One of the things I think of, and I'm always, wondering, how can a big city that has a lot of experience all of a sudden say, oh, we're going to start doing that too? Are you not looking at your history? Are you not looking at the history of what other operations in the fire service have been through? And where I'm going with this is that let's go back, because I know we brought this guy's name up before, Warren Kimball, who talked about engines and trucks. And the truck boss was always the combat engineer. Today, you got, like I said, somebody from some, who knows where they're from, who can stand in front of a crowd and turn the skin off a snake, and they got an agenda or whatever. You know, it's like everybody needs to do this. This is wrong. No. You take it back to your department. Big cities, this is the way we operate. We got engines, we got ladders. That truck boss was always the combat engineer. It was his job to go around that building and check while the engine guys focused on water. And that's the way it still should be, because the cities haven't changed. The buildings haven't gone away. You've still got engines and ladders operating. If you need to fine tune your operation, that's fine, but don't just do this wholesale change of how you do business. That's going to cause resentment among your firefighters who have been doing it and who know this job too. It's like, oh my God, why are we changing so forth? Because what, some guy out of East Bum, whatever the hell, Bum Fuck, why, wherever, has got this program out there and so forth. I'll probably end up getting it out tonight. But it's true, that's,
It comes back to what Jerry was saying. The technical information is very useful. Mm-hmm. The interpretation that is mm-hmm. where we lose it as a mm-hmm. as a service. Everybody wants to take their piece home, make it theirs, and then turn around and sell it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the profiteers come in, and that's where the message gets muddled up, and it's not in line with the principles of the fire service, which is to save lives.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I gotta tell you a quick story. I think it's on us though, the receivers. My fire department is my volunteer department is big on fast team stuff, right? So we're doing this fast team drill one night. We throw the mannequin in. We have this collapse simulator. We get the mannequin in there, and I go, "It's a fireman down." I tell them before the scenario, "It's a fireman down, and he's able to talk to you." So these guys go in and they're scurrying around and they're killing themselves. I go, "It's my leg," so I'm talking as the victim. "It's my leg." "What's the matter with your leg?" "It's broken." So 10 minutes later, they drag this mannequin out. By now, they've stripped his turnout gear off the mannequin, and they're all proud of themselves because they got this guy outside. And I go, like, "Guys, I'm probably dead by now." "Well, there was some choice words, I'm like, "I had a broken leg. What was the rush?" And they were so ingrained in fast, we gotta be fast, that they lost sight of the whole thing. And I think we do this with the studies a lot, that we don't see the big picture.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah.
there's no doubt in my mind that a lot of personal and professional relationships suffered over the last several years over these debates. But, you know, it needs to, I guess that kind of talk needs to happen, no? But look what it has given birth to. You know, it has re-energized a lot of people back into the fire service because they're, you know, let's face it, we all like to argue a little bit at least.
No.
Jeff D.
Yes, sir.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah.
No.
It's just two questions.
Once, it was one, now it's two?
Yeah, yeah.
Once, next is going to be three.
One's for the old guys, and one's for John. Okay.
You're talking about that?
I'm talking about you old guys with gray hair.
They're not me.
Oh.
Okay, so John, how do you approach a young firefighter who's listening to this podcast? How do you address them after they watch this at the FTA for Cleveland? And the second question for the other guys on the board, how does a seasoned firefighter or officer interpret the podcast tonight and move forward?
I'll start with you since you asked me first. A cadet comes up to me and wants to know, you know, I will stick by what I said earlier, that there is a time and a place for transitional attack, and there always will be. There was way before I was born, and there will be way after I'm off this earth. We will have to do transitional attack. It should not be our main objective when we roll out of the station. And I'll stick by that.
I'll take the next step then.
Go ahead. All right,
and I'll do so because, you know, youth before wisdom, right, Jeff?
Run with it.
All right, so it depends on the cadet. It depends on the new person. Like, are they coming to me, but they have a few years on, or are they coming to ask me because they have a few days on? You know, if they have a few days on, I want them to understand where they're going to be at a fire. They're going to be right behind their senior guy, and the default position is to get the line into the building. And I would let them mature as, you know, to make that decision process of when you need to do exterior water. You know, typically if you can feel it before you get to the door, yeah, you're probably gonna need some exterior water. You know, if there's a delay in getting the door, if there's the circumstances are there, like John was talking, they will happen. But if they're new to the job where they don't know much of anything about it, I would say set their default setting to getting the line in. And then the rest of it comes with experience.
See, we said the same thing. He just says it much nicer.
You'll wait till the other guys
talk. Okay, so repeat your question. Please, you remember it? No, seriously, there's a reason why I'm going to do that.
So the question for a Shoop and Nap.
Yeah.
With the information that the UL and this have provided.
Yeah.
And after hearing our podcast, how would you answer a 15-plus captain that wants to ask you later, like, I watch your podcast, I've interpreted the UL and this studies, and how can I move forward with all the feedback? Because people hear us talk and they read the information online, and it creates this mass mud pie of shit. So how would you simply break it down for that veteran/new officer?
Jerry, you want to go, or you want me to go first?
I'm ready. So I had this very impassioned discussion with a very seasoned fire officer about how UL was all bullshit and all the rest of it. And I finally said to him, did you read the report, any of it? And he said, no, but this is what I heard. So read the report. You don't have to agree with it, but read it and read the tactical consideration. Don't read 300 pages. Nobody's reading that. Read the tactical considerations.
Read the
directions. So and decide for yourself. Sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
No, that was great. No, it's a great segue. Okay, so what I'm going to say is, Number one, take a look at your department and start at the top and see your department's culture, or look at your department's culture, I should say. All right. Are they open for this discussion? For example, let's say you've got a fire chief, for example, and you know his background, and maybe he has other things. And John's smiling right now.
I'm concerned. And that's all.
Yeah. And the fire chief has an agenda, and it might not meet with the culture of his department, his or her department. And something like this comes out, and the guy says to his underlings, you're going to make sure this is the way we're going to do business. And how are the guys going to take that? Because that's going to filter down through the ranks. It's going to cause resentment right off the bat. When we started this conversation tonight, we talked about things like Project Fires getting started back a long, long time ago. And we used science to help us get to where we are today for the protection of our firefighters, for our SCBAs, for the development of better hose materials to flow more water and so forth. And there was a lot of other things. So why are we dealing with people or having officers at the chief level who are just going in and saying, you're going to do this and this is it, or else heads are going to roll. And you've got guys who are proud about the jobs that they have done for the fire departments that they work on in the past. But to have something like this, and to me, it's questionable. You heard our conversations tonight. So, yeah, I don't want it to where it's a mass change because you're going to destroy your organization, your fire department, okay? The pride and so forth, you know, that chief is no good for that department and so forth. And what that do to the intermediate officers, the chiefs and the company officers, it makes them fearful of their positions. Think about that. So that's another destructive force to a fire department like that. When we're just going to say, nope, this is the way it's going to be from now on, whether you like it or not, that's it. Okay. You're talking about a new person or younger people or an officer who's showing an actual interest in this stuff. And they're not allowed to. And that's a sad thing, because that's a lot of stuff that we see out there in our country today. It's this way or not. And if you don't like it, well, that's too bad, or stuff like that, you know? And that's where I think, you know, I've got my positions on things, but at least I think I've been willing to read it. Hell, I got this stuff here, my own copies of this and other studies and so forth. I've been in contact with Jeff throughout the years and Jerry throughout the year. Jerry and I go back a zillion years together. So it's not like you're anti or against this stuff, but let's take a look at it, okay? And that's a thing that I think we got to do. What are we trying to do? You guys have already discussed it. You've already brought it up. We're trying to do our job the best we can, the way we think it should be done. Somebody sitting in an office down at headquarters or somewhere like that and so forth and saying, oh, I want my guys going in there. They got to hit it hard from the yard first before anything. That is destructive to your department right there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your firefighters know what they're doing out there, especially if your operations is seeing fires on a regular basis. They know what they can handle. And if somebody gets injured, for God's sake, guess what? That's the job. So many people are afraid. Like I said earlier, in the academies, we're taught to be so fearful. Oh my God, we don't want to, you know, have that happen or whatever. You know, we're on the wrong track. And that's why I said a little bit ago, maybe what we need to do is throw all this stuff out and regroup, start over, but go back to the principles of firefighting the way they should be. Hey, that answer your question for me? Right. Go ahead, Jer.
I got a quick story. So I teach engine company operations at my fire academy, and we have a burn building. And so we get a hose line after we've done our stretch and stuff, we get a hose line positioned near the front door, and there's a front door to the house, and there's a big picture window on the right side. Right. So I back them out to the sidewalk and I go, okay, your first due with this house fire, there is fire blowing out this front door, right? You know, it's blowing out into the sidewalk. I said, what are you going to do? And a lot of times they'll say, I'm going to put water on from the outside. I say, okay, that's fine. And then you're going in, right? Yep, yep, then we're going in. Okay, that's great. So now I move them about 4 feet over and I open that window. And I said, there's heavy fire blowing out of this window across the sidewalk, just like it was coming out of the door. Would you put water in that window? No, no, we can't put water in that window. We're not supposed to do that. So why not? Because it's a window. I go, what difference does it make? 4 feet over here, you just have a different hole, different size hole in the building. Now, I'm not saying that's the first choice, but if for some reason entry is delayed, there's a collapse on the first floor, there's a guy with a gun, whatever it might be there, it's an option. It's an option. And we pay these guys, and we train officers and firefighters to look at the scenario, figure what they got, and figure out the best tactic. And I think one of the things we've all kind of touched on but haven't got to is, what's our mission? What's our mission at this fire? Is it rescue? Is it getting water on a fire quick? And if everybody understands the mission on the fire ground, and Jeff, you talked about this, the operational procedure culture, and John hit it too, of the department. If the first option is to get inside, you should try to do that if you can. If you can't, you have to do something else. So, and the reason I do that thing on the sidewalk is I want the guys to think. I just want them to think, you know? You can't pull up to a fire and go, this is what we do all the time, you know? But if you got a broken leg, that patient gets different treatment than if he's got chest pain. For crying out loud, you know, you don't put a splint on the guy's leg because he's having chest pain, because that's what we do all the time, you know? So we just got to think, you know? Big picture. Sorry. Yeah. I got my soapbox out.
No, good soapbox. And it leads to, you know, that's what where experience helps. When you start thinking your way through a fire instead of just reacting your way through a fire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that I get me personally, it comes with not only just experience on the job, but getting older too. You know, you just move more with a purpose. You're not just kind of reacting to what's around you. You're thinking about where you need to go into that building to make it better.
And your sequence, I thought before, was perfect. Okay, there's not fire below me, so now I can know I can get in there. So you're making those critical decisions based on what you're seeing. Like Jeff Shoup says, it's situational, and you have a process to go through, which is perfect.
Right. I think we hit quite a bit here. We started out with the history of how technology and information has come into the fire service, and how the fire service has always been changing. It's never stayed the same. And then when you add in the complexities of how different the fire service is around the country, I mean, there's nothing the same about this job anywhere other than people call because there's a problem and we show up to fix it. We moved into some of the other studies. We just touched on a couple of them. Talked about the impression they've made on the fire service, especially through the fire academies, and how they're across all 50 states, and how these studies are essentially how they get funded is because they have a teaching component, and that teaching component gets rolled out. So it's up to us to interpret the information. Jeff, do you want to round us out here and get us going out the door? We're close. We're a little bit over time.
Oh, that's okay. No, we got plenty of time.
No, Jeff, we don't.
Do you have a hot tub date tonight or what?
Yeah, we might.
Geez, I don't know. What can I say? You know, I guess I have strong feelings about, again, we never turned our back on it. You hit it right in the head. We've always been moving forward in the fire service. The guys nowadays, like I said, they don't realize what the older firefighters had gone through to get to where we are today. But it's something, if you want change, don't expect it to happen overnight. And don't do it for the sake of change. And that's another thing I think we got into. We got to change. Why do we have to change? Because we got to be progressive. Being progressive isn't always the best thing to be. Okay? And that's for damn sure. And so I think what we discussed tonight, you know, going back to, like you said, Project Fires, we like the guys on that, our turnout gear. We use science. We used it for that. We used it for the development of our turnout gear to get the best materials out there. And we're still seeing that, by the way. Look at the way fire hose is manufactured now compared to the old rubber line cotton jacket hose.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So we're seeing the sciences used to cut friction losses and increase flows for the firefighters, things like that. And as for the way fires are handled, honest to God, we need to go back and read Warren Kimball's work. Honest to God, look, like I said, to me it's insulting for a big city to say, oh, just you know they got their fire history. Why would you just let somebody come in and tell you, no, you're doing it wrong, you're going to do it this way? But that's a local thing also. So I guess I'm just prejudiced in that regard and so forth. Can a small city or a small department do that? Sure they can. Just it's absolutely something that's able to be done and so forth. So I don't know. Give me some help here or chime in where you see you've got an opening.
I think we've covered quite a bit here. Jerry, do you want to help us send us off here?
I'll try. Again, I come back to you just have to mix the new studies with your experience, figure out what works for you. Jeff, I think your point of the fire service is, you know, you have career departments with 20 guys on an engine. You have volunteers with that Slappy and Pappy show up, you know, on Tuesday morning. So what the studies show is the facts about how fire develops and some different techniques to put those fires out or control those fires. And it's up to you to find all the variables. Like Shoup says, it's situational. Do the right thing in the right situation and you're off to the races.
Yeah.
But hey, let me jump in here real quick. Jerry, you just hit on something. A friend of ours who a few of us know is living out in northwestern United States now. And he is going to be, he's going to be taken on to the volunteer fire department where he now lives. And this is out in the middle of nowhere. And he is 71 years old, our old friend. And he's the youngest guy.
Wow.
So when you said Pappy and Slappy is showing up Tuesday morning, you're not off the mark at all. You are right on. And see, this is the whole thing about firefighting. It's different no matter where you go. It's circumstantial, it's local, it's geographical. But yeah, can imagine that? So they get a fire. Are you expecting those guys to do wholesale changes to their fire department? Because, look what they got. A bunch of old people who have taken care of their little town all these years, and that's where they've done it. No way.
Yeah, good example.
Yeah.
John, Micah?
I was going to say, as long as their turnout time isn't too long and it ruins their ISO rating, then... You gotta be careful about that stuff. Go back a little bit further in the conversation, but Jerry was talking about all these different studies, and it seems like what's old is new again. What we knew 50, 75, 100 years ago, we now have science that can help confirm what we already knew.
We knew 100 years ago.
But this new study comes out and says, hey, this is what happens. We're like, yeah, we kind of already knew that. We've been doing that. Yeah. But, they can put computers in there and they can tell us exactly what's happening. And that's great. Take it for what it's worth. You young guys out there listening, be careful who don't just take one person's opinion on how to fight fires and stuff like that. Don't jump on Facebook or YouTube and say this is the way it is.
A lot of identity theft on Facebook and YouTube.
I've heard about it, and that's all I got.
Okay, Micah.
I think I'll just have to piggyback off what John and everyone else has said. I was considered to be a millennial. I would really encourage new and millennials to do their homework, read the names that Shoup and Knapp, we've all mentioned several times in our podcast, as are on our websites, and filter that information and find and surround yourself with good people, solid people, experienced people.
That's about as good as it gets right there. I mean, if you can get the experience-based people around you, give you firsthand knowledge, it goes a long way.
I just want to throw out some love to our guy from South America who can't be on tonight.
Yeah, Chad Grivers is dealing with some personal situation with his family, and he couldn't be here tonight. But
hope all is well, Chad.
Yeah, it'll get better. It'll get better. All right, Wes. Well, thanks for rounding out tonight. Keep an eye out for the Fire Engineering website and the new magazine next month. Jeff's got an article, you know, teeing up on the 2-inch hose, so we're looking forward to that. And FDIC is really around the corner, so we're anxious to get back out there and see everybody and get to doing what we do. So with that, I'd say bid everyone well, good night, and be well.
Take care.